All right, if everyone's here and ready to go, we'll start our last panel of the day. Thanks for sticking around. We're going to start with maintaining the musician, protecting music, image and technology today. I'm sorry about my voice. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panelists. First is Joseph F. Brezel. Sorry. He's senior counsel at Loeb & Loeb here in Nashville, handling business and legal affairs for a variety of musician labels and publishers and writers. His practice area covers a variety of IP issues, including reported products, internet, and new media. He's a licensed patent attorney, and prior to joining Loeb & Loeb, he served as vice president of business affairs at EMI Music here in Nashville. To his left, we have Elizabeth Gregory, who, since graduating the University of Southern California, has worked in entertainment litigation, first in Los Angeles at the law firm of Stein, Kahn, and Rosenberg, and following that at a boutique, also in LA, Myman, Abel, Finman, Greenspan, and Light. I don't know if I got all those right. And now she is running her own boutique practice here in Nashville and Maryland. No, that's true, sorry. And specializing in the representation of successful major independent label artists, songwriters, independent labels, publishers, and producers. Next to her, on her left, is Kenneth Sanny. He is an attorney at Day & Blair in Brentwood, practicing in copyright, trademark, technology, and entertainment law and litigation. He also teaches music business and law in the Department of Recording Industry in the College of Mass Communication at MTSU. He also created and authors the Sanny Copyright and Music Law blog and writes a feature column for ENS, the Tennessee Bar Association's Entertainment and Sports Law Quarterly Newsletter. And finally, to his left, we have Cheryl Slay, who is a professor of music business at Belmont University, where she teaches copyright and trademark, and also has a solo practice where she focuses on business strategy and maintains offices in Nashville and Maryland. She writes on EP and entertainment matters and recently authored an article entitled MySpace or WhoSpace, Website Operation Under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act for the Maryland Bar Journal. And she's also a singer-songwriter. And finally, our moderator today is Suzanne Kessler, who is a law professor here at Vanderbilt, teaching entertainment transactions and intellectual property licensing, She also is an entertainment attorney and documentary filmmaker. She directed business and legal affairs for A&M Records while at Universal Music Group in Hollywood and served as vice president of business development for UMG's Nashville operations. She also recently co-produced a film for A&E, the network, entitled Hairdos and Heartaches, The Women of Country Music. So with that, I'll let you take the floor. Thanks.
Okay, so last panel of the day on a Friday afternoon. Thanks to everyone for coming into and for sticking around. What we're going to do, I think, first is we'll have the speakers self-introduce a little bit more descriptively and in particular about their practices and how they got into their practices in this area of music, and we'll go from there. So, Joe?
Okay. Am I too loud with the mic? All right. I tend to project, so forgive me. My practice is probably about 95% entertainment and probably about 5% patent work. A few years ago, I started realizing there were some developments happening in the patent world and thought that these two worlds were going to intersect. So most of what I do through the day is entertainment and primarily in the music field. I try to avoid film and TV and that stuff because we do live in Nashville. The bulk of my clients, it varies between companies, or in our world we'll talk about the companies versus talent. You know, so the companies would be the record labels, the music publishers, the entities who are paying the bills and the talent, people who receive the money from the stuff that pays the bills. Probably about two-thirds of what I do is representing the company side, just because I've got a lot of experience working for EMI here in Nashville. And about the other third, representing bands and singers and writers and that sort of thing. How did I get into the business? When I was in law school, I wanted to be an FBI agent. I wanted to kick down doors and throw people on the floor and all that stuff. But I graduated in a time period a lot like this, where the economy was in a big downturn, and moved to Nashville and was just working for a small firm downtown. And one day in church, I met a guy who was the CEO of a small record label. And he said, "I understand you're a brand new lawyer." And I said, "Yeah." And he very, very foolishly hired me to be his in-house lawyer, because I knew nothing. And about 9 months later, the record company was bought up by EMI, and it just went from there.
You mean music lawyers don't kick down doors?
Yeah, there's some stories. Yeah. you get to work some of that out, yeah, when you work for the record company.
Hey, Elizabeth?
With the clients I have, I spend more of my time hiding under my desk than kicking down doors. anyway, sometimes I try to act big and tough. Most of what I do is work with larger independent artists who pay for their own recordings, own their masters, sometimes administer their own publishing, and we do a lot of licensing. My whole world is about licensing. We divide the world into territories. We license records for 5 to 7 years per territory. We license a lot of stuff to film and TV and for commercials. And we get everything back after a certain amount of time, and we do it all again. And my clients tend to have very long careers. Some of them are on record 8, 9, or 10, and will send me a note every once in a while that says, "Thank you for everything you've done for me this decade," which is a little bit different from what I was doing when I was in Los Angeles at the boutique, which was big, fat, overloaded major label record deals. I've almost always done stuff on behalf of talent instead of labels, though I have worked with a couple of smaller labels who keep me busy doing some really insane things. I wish they'd call me before they did stuff instead of afterwards, but next lifetime for them, maybe. And the way I got into it is kind of, I really was headed this way from the time I was in high school, ending high school. I grew up in a neighborhood that had a lot of musicians in it for some reason, and they tended to be nicer to me than anybody else for some reason. That was back in the heyday of punk rock, and actually my husband is a punk rock musician. I've known him 20 years, and that was back in the heyday of the indie punk rock labels. So that may be why I have that sort of indie bent to my career, but I've found that I'm much happier operating in that world. And spent all of my time in college and law school doing internships, and I actually worked at a litigation boutique all the way through my third year of law school, and frankly, my contacts were a lot more impressive than my grades, and that's what mattered. And to get into the business, I had my first client, the one I'm married to now, and two labels desperately wanted to sign this guy, and they said, "What do you want, Elizabeth?" Because we've offered him everything we can think of, including hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I said, "Well, I want a new job." And within a week, I had a new job at Myman Abel, Fineman, Greenspan, and now it's Light and Fox and a bunch of other people, I don't know. So I did that and then jumped off the fast track and came here and moved into a slightly different niche, and so I may have a slightly different perspective. It seems that's a pretty different part. The business has become dichotomized between the 360 deal and the majors trying to survive on one side, and then what I'm doing on the other side, which is people owning their content and licensing it for relatively short periods. So that should be good for conversation.
Okay, we're definitely going to talk about that a little bit more. And maybe this should be the ethics panel, because we've already talked about kicking down doors and marrying your clients, so. Ken?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the Journal for putting on just a first-class symposium and all the hospitality they've shown to us, so thank you. The way I got involved in the entertainment industry was I graduated from Vanderbilt Law School. I was on the Journal. I was a member on the Journal. And I wanted to litigate. I was a former police officer, and I really just wanted to do litigation. So I went out and worked at a very small firm and did litigation work for pretty much around 4 or 5 years of straight litigation. My very first day of practicing law, I actually tried a case in juvenile court, believe it or not. And that does happen rarely, so don't panic when you go out there to practice law. It probably won't happen to you. And then through my making contacts and doing general litigation, I started meeting some people in the industry, because I was litigating here. And I was doing everything from divorce work to criminal defense work. And you'd be surprised how well that dovetails with the entertainment industry. And so you start meeting people and making connections. And my ultimate goal really was to work my way into the entertainment industry. I always had a big interest in copyright law and entertainment contracts and those types of things. So I used my litigation skills and those types of assets that I had to work my way toward doing more entertainment work. And it just slowly progressed to the point where that's pretty much the vast, vast majority, probably 90% of my practice now. So I am a litigator, so if I keep looking like I want to stand up, sitting in a seat and talking is not usually what I do. So, but if any of you want to get involved in the entertainment industry, what I would suggest for the law students in the room is you have to be persistent. It's not the type of industry that for the most part you can go out and join just a big firm, get mentored into the field, and just eventually develop your own clients. You really have to be persistent and work your way in.
Okay. Cheryl?
Good afternoon. That's a really good segue for talking about sort of how my practice developed. I am recently transplanted here to Nashville. I'm coming from the Baltimore area, from Maryland, where I have been for the last many, many years. And Maryland, of course, Baltimore and DC, there's lots going on there in the arts in general, but not really at all a primary entertainment market. And so in terms of developing a practice, I started thinking about entertainment and intellectual property issues when I was in law school. Even though I'm a singer-songwriter, I wasn't drawn to entertainment law for that reason. Long story, which I will save for some private conversation for anybody who wants to talk to me later, but long story is that I was really interested in museum law and visual art. And I wound up talking to an attorney at the Smithsonian in the general counsel's office and one of the curators there, who said, well, you really should think about copyright law issues and that kind of thing. I was in law school at the time, had no idea what art law was, started to go back to my professors, ask some questions, who suggested that I pursue it, even though, of course, there was no major or concentration or coursework or any outlet for any of that at all. And I've been out of law school many years now, so there was no entertainment law coursework. None of this stuff existed. So I connected with a professor in my law school who had an interest in these issues. He just had a real interest in intellectual property. He really wasn't even our intellectual property faculty. It was just an interest that he had. We connected, and I started to gear all of my writing requirements in law school towards arts, entertainment, intellectual property, and for whatever reasons, just was very drawn to that as a subject matter area. And then, as a practical matter, when I left law school and thought about developing a specific practice area, even though I was interested in arts, the visual arts, fine arts, entertainment law seemed a more practical route to take. And so that's the route I took as a sole practitioner. And in Maryland, I think if you're going, or anywhere, I think this is probably true for Nashville, if you're going to be a sole practitioner in a niche market where there are not a slew of clients, even in a good economy, I had to sort of make my way in this entertainment world, which required me to figure out what my business model was going to be. Would I do something like estate law on the side to just be able to put a roof over my head and eat and take entertainment matters when I could? I made a decision, and in a lengthier discussion for another time, but I made a decision that I would take some risks, do what I really wanted to do. Law school was a third degree for me and a second career. So I decided that I would do exactly what I wanted to do. I just decided that I would develop a business model that would support that. All a very long way of saying that my practice is very business oriented. I set up entertainment companies. I help clients understand how to manage corporate matters and to deal with these regular business issues that every company has to deal with, entertainment or not. The other aspect of my practice is very intellectual property focused in terms of registrations, copyright registrations and contracting, some licensing. And then it's always been, even though the industry is changing a lot, it's always been a sort of strategic counseling practice. So clients don't understand the business, and I help them understand the business. Very education-oriented. So it makes sense that I find myself now at Belmont teaching as faculty, because that's always the way I've approached my practice. You come in for a consultation with me, we sit down at my whiteboard, and we talk about really specific career strategy issues. So that's kind of how I've found myself where I am.
Interesting. And just by way of an aside, if anyone has any career-oriented questions, I know that I'm certainly happy at any time outside of this context to answer those, and I'm certain that others on the panel would agree that they'd be available as well. Elizabeth?
Right, and my intern is about to graduate from here.
Oh, okay.
I am totally intern dependent, so, and I don't care if you're any good, I just care if you want to do it.
Okay. There you go, okay.
No prerequisites.
Today's discussion on some of the other panels has been very much labor issue oriented, and some of the issues touched upon have been union-oriented or collective bargaining agreements and other areas like that. It's interesting to me, as I've been listening to the other panels, to note that that's something that on a daily basis, we rarely deal with those types of issues. It's very different from some of the other fields that you've heard discussed today. And we're going to briefly touch on two kind of forks in the labor road. One is literally, what is maybe the relationship between the unions and the artists and or the labels? Like how, in other words, how do we, when we do deal with union issues, how do they come up? And then the second aspect, second prong of the fork in terms of labor-oriented issues I want to touch on, has to do with the artist-label relationship. But maybe, Joe, if you could just kind of briefly describe how, when union issues do come up, what are they? How do they come up?
Sure. Forgive me, today I'm in label mode. I've been dealing with label stuff all day, so I'll kind of approach this from the label perspective. The union issues, from my end in the music business, just, they're not dramatic and they don't tend to come up very often. Usually it's a pretty simple affair. You know, there are, I guess, two primary unions involved in the music business. There's the AFM, which is really the musicians union. So if you play lead guitar and don't sing, you'll be a member of the AFM. And then there's AFTRA, which is sort of the union for the singers. And from the labels side, it's a pretty simple affair. They have a huge, huge, huge agreement that goes on and on and on. There's all these different parts. But the bottom line is pretty much sign or die. You know, it's not something that's negotiated. On one level, it is negotiated, but it's negotiated with one lawyer who represents three of the majors, and I think one guy represents the fourth major. And they'll do their thing with the unions in New York about every 4 or 5 years, but that's about it. once those companies agree to this collective bargaining agreement, everybody else, if you want to join, either as a label or an artist, they say, here it is. And a lot of times they won't even send you the book. They'll send you the signature page, and it says, I've read all this stuff. So as far as how does it impact the daily life, at least here in Nashville, of labels and musicians, my experience has been not that much. It's a pretty simple affair that when you record a record or, download, whatever, when you make a musical product, you're going to pay a certain percentage of the money you earn to the union. There's issues about how much you're going to pay the artists. And these payment terms are all really set out in stone in the union agreement. There's sometimes an issue with some of the smaller labels, and I represent a few of those as well, who they don't want to be union members. They feel that the union adds too much to their overhead, and they're going to try to do it without the unions. And that's a tough proposition, especially in Nashville. There's some cities where it's easier to record a project non-union, but it's a lot tougher here in Nashville. So those things pop up from time to time, the issue of whether a label's signed or not, sometimes whether a musician is signed or not. Once in a blue moon, one of the labels will buy a record that's pre-existing, but say it wasn't recorded under union rules, so you have to unionize it. But it's really just not that big of an issue.
What about the other panelists? Do you feel the same way, that on a daily basis you just don't deal with union issues?
It comes up in three places. One, if you're producing a record, and if it's for a major label, then you've got to have someone to do the union paperwork and submit who was in on which sessions, how long they were there, et cetera, what their role was. If you sing in a commercial, then you may want to join SAG because you will get residuals. And then it can come up if you are performing on a record for a major. Most of the indie labels I deal with, you're right, they would rather go out of business than deal with the unions, and they don't. And most of the records I deal with are non-union. I will tell you that if you are not a union member and you, or even if you are, if you perform on someone else's record and you need to get paid for it, you go to the label and they say, go hire these people to do it for you, because the paperwork is so technical that trying to negotiate through all that yourself, I'm not talking about like actually change the terms, I'm just talking about getting the blanks filled in correctly, is so hard. And they have so much of this stuff they have to do that it's probably not fair for anyone. Just pay the outside company to do your paperwork and you'll get paid a lot faster. In the indie label world and with all of the people who have home studios now, it used to be you had to go to the big recording studio, but with all the home studios now, or smaller studios, in my world, it really doesn't come up.
I would echo Elizabeth's comments. So many different types of entertainment practices, as you can hear on the panel, and for a practice that does not really represent, that represents indies and is really not interacting with the majors that much, it is non-existent, virtually non-existent. I do represent folks in literary publishing, as well as I've represented some actors and folks who do voiceovers and that kind of thing, and I've dealt with some union issues on that end. But in the music world, very, very little for the indie world.
Okay. In terms of the other definition of labor that I was talking about, the relationship between artist and label, is that an employer-employee relationship? Is it an independent contractor relationship?
I'll go ahead and try to take the first stab at that. Just back a few years ago, we had in the Copyright Act was this issue where, after hearings and everything had been conducted, there was a clause inserted that made all recordings a work for hire. That lasted about 11 months. you can Google that and find out, you know, there are people from every walk of the industry that was outside of the employer, the labels, who were railing against that. Courtney Love had a big speech that's all over the internet still to today about that. So it really comes down to when you are a recording artist and you're going into the studio to record an album, you have a recording artist contract with your label in which you are going to provide these exclusive services as a recording artist. And the copyright to the resultant work would be looked at from copyright law as owned by a producer and the recording artist. But really what the recording artist does is signs over their ownership of the resulting work in exchange for royalties. So it kind of breaks down along those lines. When they tried to make it a work for hire, it really became the labels trying to take this copyrighted work and expand their ownership of it out past 35 years for some copyright issues that...
Yeah. Do you guys think that's typical of how major record labels have operated historically, that they've just, the power balance has always been tilted toward the label, and if it hadn't been, then the label would try for these power grabs to have more leverage, especially with a new artist. I mean, traditionally, wasn't that the case? Everyone's smiling first.
Oh, you want me to attack you afterwards?
I can see like all the stories in their brains about these issues.
Okay. All right, I'll be label dude for right now. Okay. Power grab, it's fair, it's not fair. Artist gets screwed, label gets screwed. I try to look at it pragmatically. Last time I looked, when I was working at EMI, 9 out of 10 acts were severe money losers for the label. So, and you know, these days it's probably even more, where you've got a company that invests a huge amount of money, and they go into it knowing, due to past history, this is probably going to cost us a lot of money. So, with that background in mind, the way I try to analyze what happens between leverage between, you know, who's got the leverage between the artist and the label. And it varies. It varies a lot. I used to do a lot of work with Capitol Nashville here in town, and they have an artist who I won't name, but who could very well get whatever this artist wants. And in fact, there are many, many artists in the country field that are this way, where they're so successful and they sell so many albums and they make so much money at concerts, they really don't even need a label. They can go hire their own staff and do their own thing. That's one end of the spectrum where, you know, they turn to the label and say, what do you have to offer me that I can't already do for myself? At the complete other end of the spectrum is, say, a brand new artist who has no real demonstrated track record of success. You know, they might have a good sound, they might have a good look, but, you know, say they've not made a record, they've not sold any units, that's a very risky proposition for the record company. So I don't know if many people in here are like students of kind of basic economics. I am. I was an econ major in college. And I look at it like it's really an allocation of risk and benefit. If it's a brand new artist and who's not sold, you know, I don't know, 5,000-10,000 units a year, they're not out on the road doing a lot of shows, making a lot of money, that is a more risky venture for the record company. And so what they will try to do is minimize the risk, frankly, by a lower payout. And because it is, under basic risk-benefit analysis, the label's taking the bigger risk on an unproven act, shall we say. So, you know, sometimes it makes sense that they might also get a higher reward for taking the bigger risk. Same thing on the opposite end of the spectrum, when you've got a, you know, hugely successful artist, some of the biggest record deals that come to mind are like Rolling Stones with the Virgins, Garth Brooks with Capitol. Some of those, I mean, those are guaranteed winners. The label's going to sell a whole lot of units, and they're going to make a whole lot of money on that deal. And in that case, the artist gets a whole lot more. So, you know, now that's the the cold, hard business logic of the balance of leverage, at least in my opinion.
I agree. It's all about risk. And the problem is that no one knows why some records work. And it doesn't matter how many focus groups you do or, you know, how many kids are coming to the shows or how much chatter there is on the internet. You just don't know why some of them are going to work. And this business model where you are, for some reason, at major labels, there's sort of this like, it's more expensive for them to do everything than it is for an indie label. It's more expensive for them to distribute, manufacture, record, pay producers. So it's very, very expensive. And they are betting with each project millions of dollars. So, and they're not going to make it on 99 out of 100. So they've got to really make it big on that one that breaks through. And it used to be when we were doing, for a while there, and some of this has changed as the major label world has gotten more corporate, as these companies have become the properties of conglomerates who do more than one thing, and the people at the top want to see an ever-increasing growth curve in sales. And now you have to report your numbers. It used to be, you know, a couple times a year, then it was quarterly, and you know, before long it was like, once a month, every couple of weeks, you got to meet these numbers. And so, you know, you become ever more desperate to find the ones that are going to break through, and you don't have any rational basis, really, for choosing which ones. And so you have a couple of things happening where you have maybe fewer deals, but they're bigger. They become bidding war situations, and those can be a lot of fun. And it doesn't matter if your client has played a single show or sold a single record, you can have a huge bidding war situation. In the last year or so, I can think of one local firm in particular that has found that that model is not working so well. They had a business model where they were going to, you know, bat for the moon every single time. Every proposal that went out was going to be a minimum of $1 million in advances in recording funds for the artists. And all of a sudden, the label started saying, we don't even want to talk to you. We're not, don't call us. We're not even going to respond to your proposal. So there's definitely some change going on there. When I was doing major label deals, the way it was viewed from the artist side was, you got the biggest advance you could because there was only two sources of money coming to you out of that deal. One of them was the advance, and one of them was your publishing, because if you sold, you know, 100,000 records or 150,000 records, that was a failure to the label. But as far as the publishing that had to be paid to you, regardless of your recoupment status, which means that, you know, most of the money that the label spends on you, they are going to get it back before you give you anything else, except with regard to publishing. So, you know, there it was. You bid them up, every single one of them, as high as you could. When you're in the indie world, it's completely different. And sometimes my clients pass on advances entirely to say, you know what, $10,000 is not that much money to us. Give us a 28% royalty rate instead.
And in that spirit, do you find that independent labels, I mean, obviously one of the major differences between the major labels and independent labels is that the indies have less money to spend, but are the indies more nimble in that way? Is there more flexibility in terms of the deals an artist might be able to strike? And also, in that spirit, is it more of a partnership even between artist and label?
Any thoughts on that?
More of a dysfunctional marriage is what it is. And you would be surprised at how much some of the indies are spending these days. I've got one artist right now who's very hot. I mean, you've seen him in Vanity Fair. You've seen him in Rolling Stone. He's been on all the nighttime shows. And the label is spending $20,000 a month promoting his record.
Wow.
His advance was, I don't know if it was $150,000 or $250,000. He was viewed as a sure bet, but the label has bet the farm on it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't happen, I don't know who's going to bail him out.
That's an indie that's spending that kind of money?
Yeah, and so there are a handful of indies that can spend that kind of money. Somebody like Sub Pop can spend it. Someone like Fat Possum can spend it on one person, you know, and it is increasingly becoming. They have like one marquee act, and, you know, that's carrying the label.
Interesting. I was going to say, one of the things, just to fill in some of the picture here, what I'd said earlier about the copyright issue and the labor relations between artists and the labels wasn't to just take the artist's side. When you look at a label, an advance, which a lot of people don't really understand what an advance is in the music industry, an advance is a no-interest loan that never has to be repaid back except from the artist's royalties. So that's like the best loan on the planet. That's bailout loan money there. It's hard to find a loan that you pay no interest in, and you only pay back if you succeed. So the label is taking large risks, and as Joe said, historically, what is it, about 1 in 10 acts recoup. Recoup means that they pay back that advance out of the sales, out of their royalties, out of sales of their album. So the label is taking a large risk on each and every act. Now, sometimes it's a larger risk than others. If you're a label and you sign the Rolling Stones, not so much of a risk now. But, you know, if you're signing a brand new act that does not have that track record, as Joe said, you just don't know. And like Elizabeth said, you can run all the focus groups you want. What's going to appeal to the masses today may not be the same as what appealed to them just yesterday. So that allocation of risk is really difficult when we've been based on a system for a very long time that works on no interest advances that never have to be paid back except from royalties. Digital technology and all the other things that are going on has really caused a lot of problems where that's concerned. You just don't have the money in the pipeline to be able to dole that out and hope 1 out of 10 acts hits anymore.
Now, of course, in exchange for that risk, for putting all that money out, the majors have traditionally said, okay, we're going to own everything, all output from the artist. So they are taking a huge risk, but they're also saying that in return for our risk and our upfront money, we're going to take ownership. Cheryl, in your experiences with indies, is that the same way an indie deal might work, or is there more flexibility in terms of what the artist gets?
Yeah, in terms of the business in the indie world, it's like we're talking about really two very different music industries, maybe more than two, because Elizabeth's example of an indie label that can afford to give a $150,000 advance and is spending $20,000 a month, these are not my clients. These are not my clients. And therefore, there is a great deal more creativity that has to go on in terms of attracting artists when you cannot offer those kinds of advances. And certainly, with respect to copyright ownership, understood that because there is more creativity that's required, one of the things that's not going to be on the table is probably copyright ownership of masters. However, what you say, Suzanne, about partnership is a real sort of increasing phenomenon that I'm seeing. I had a discussion with a client of mine 2 days ago about an artist that she has in Maryland who is doing very well, as is customary in this indie world. Nothing is orthodox. So they've been working together for a year or more without a contract, of course, and have therefore been creating a partnership that is also unorthodox with respect to splitting expenses for what, concert performances that are really distinct from the artist's record deal, but that in the indie world there are just some very different things that go on. So what you see even is some negotiation with respect to copyrights for masters, but not that much. Artists are fairly familiar with not expecting to have that kind of copyright ownership, and certainly a lot more in terms of co-publishing deals, a lot more educated. I have lots more educated clients than I did 10 years ago when I started practicing in terms of writing and creating different revenue streams. But it's a very different way to do business.
Elizabeth?
It seems most often to turn on whether the artist can record the record themselves. If you can come to the label with your record finished, you're much more likely to be able to hold on to the ownership of your copyright and do a license deal. It may be a royalty deal, it may be a net profit split deal, but your chances are, and it's not 100%, you know, we all see plenty of examples where this doesn't happen, where the ownership does transfer, but it's that's your best bet for holding on to it.
I think that goes back to that allocation of risk when you end up having the label funding studio time, you know, and everything else. It may be recoupable. Yeah, they may get it if you succeed and sell enough albums back from your advance. When they give you a fund, you know, they have to do a lot of oversight, and you've got to give them a budget, they've got to approve it, and those types of things, because they're trying to manage that risk. They don't want to take what is a bad deal and make it a worse deal for themselves. So they're trying to oversee that risk and keep from putting out so much money into recording an album that, you know, God forbid you turn into like an Axl Rose and spend, I don't know how much he spent on that last album, but they're trying to manage those risks. If you show up with a product in hand, that's a whole different situation.
Yeah. Joe?
Yeah, and one other thing I'd like to just throw in there is it sounds like owning your own album is always a really good thing, but there are I'd go so far as to say probably 95 or 96% of all records recorded and released, after that first 6 months of release, you can't give them away. And so that's something else to consider is, you know, the vast majority of most albums that are put out, they, in the business, that we call it, you know, it's in returns. What that means is, you know, the record company shipped out, just to make the numbers round, let's say the record company shipped out 100,000 units, and let's assume we're dealing in the retail world here, which I know is decreasing every day, but, you know, like say Walmart buys 100,000 copies of some record, they've got the right to return probably most or all those units back if they don't sell to the record company. And so once the record has been released and shipped, when that record has hit the point that more units are coming back in before going out, that's called, you know, they'll say it's in returns now. And what that means is it's dead. There's just zero happening. I mean, the best chance for anything happening might be, you know, masters from iTunes, that sort of thing. From the label's perspective, now from the artist's perspective, they're probably still going to sell a lot of units at concerts, probably going to sell a lot of units from MySpace. But my point is simply that it's, you know, when I was in law school, it sounded to me like owning your own record was a really big deal. And what I'm seeing more and more as years go by is sometimes, you know, you fight real hard and you spend a lot of money on something that nobody really cares about.
You get it. That brings up another topic, which is how long is the label going to work that record?
Right.
And an indie label is going to work it a lot longer. Not always, but most of the time. They're going to be more creative, you know, 2 years down the road saying, what can we do to stimulate some sales on this thing? And if I look at one of my main clients' catalog sales, they're selling 3,400, 3,500 records a week of their catalog. And these are records that are now at the 100 to 150,000 unit mark. And those records sell, each one of them, say, 300 to 400, 500 units per week. They're still out working them. That's another place where you can have big differences between the major and the indie. Because there is, at some point with records, a diminishing rate of return for the money you invest in it. And that happens faster at the big company because everything costs them more. It costs them more to work a record to use the same person from such and such company, I don't know, Nasty Little Man for publicity. It costs the major more to hire that person than it does the indie. for radio promotion. It cost the major, until recently it was cost, and they said, cried uncle, they were saying, yeah, it's going to cost us $300,000 to work this thing, the radio. And then you've got someone like Ingrid Michaelson. I used to think that the one time you would still go to a major label was if you had a radio single, if you were a pop artist. And then, frankly, the indie labels don't want that kind of artist. They don't know what to do with it. It doesn't make sense for them, their business model, which is sort of like counterculture, frankly. And then along came Ingrid Michaelson, and she said, I'm going to own everything that's ever recorded of me, and I'm going to control everything. And she managed to do well enough on an Old Navy commercial that she went out and hired her own radio promo people. And before you knew it, she had a radio hit. No one thought that could be done.
I didn't really mean to interrupt you, but it immediately reminded me of, in the Christian gospel world, Martha Minnizzi did the same thing. She was independently recorded that very first album, went out and hired a radio promoter, and of course she was nominated for, I don't remember whether she won, but she was certainly nominated for a couple of Dove Awards for that particular first album. In the Christian world, a very significant accomplishment and garnered a lot of attention because she was able to do that without the support of a label. Now she has a label. Didn't at the time.
As we're talking about how indie labels do things a little differently from the majors being traditionally basically banks funding the CDs and then owning them, and trying to recoup their investment through sales of sound recordings, period, CD sales. As we are exploring those issues and at the same time talking about some of the creative ways artists are thinking about their own careers, their own promotion, their own sales, the 360 deal that we started hearing about a few years ago, and which has kind of become a buzz term and that all the majors started talking about a lot, but then at a certain point, very few deals were actually getting done that were so-called 360 deals. What are the 360 deals, and are they working? Why did the majors start looking at those kind of deals? How do the artists react to those kinds of deals? First of all, who wants to maybe take a stab at just giving an overview of what a 360 deal is?
I'm working on one. I'll talk about it. Traditionally, up until, I don't know, maybe I first started hearing about these maybe 5 or 6 years ago, in an exclusive recording artist agreement, the monies that the label received were usually just, as Suzanne said, from the sales of products. So sales of CDs, eventually sales of downloads. But that was it. Any other money that arose from this act usually would be go to the artist. So the artist goes out on tour and, you know, they're doing their concerts. Artist keeps all that money. Artist gets a book deal, you know, to write about their sordid past or whatever. Artist keeps all that money. Songwriting, and there's a little bit of a split here, but the Christian music world is a lot different than the secular music world, but I'll just stick with the secular for a moment. You know, the record label wouldn't touch monies arising from the royalties derived from the musical compositions that the artist might write. So, take Led Zeppelin. I always use Led Zeppelin as an example. Say if Jimmy Page was the sole writer of Stairway to Heaven, their record company is going to pay whoever owns the musical composition of Stairway to Heaven. You know, it's the difference between the copyrights and the recording and the musical composition contained in the recording. So the money from the musical compositions was also something that the record labels traditionally didn't touch. Merchandise deals where the artist allows their name, likeness, logo to be put on a t-shirt that are sold for exorbitant fees at concerts or whatever, that's all between the artist label, doesn't touch it. And commercials, endorsement deals, all that sort of stuff. That was all money that, up until very recently, it was holy ground. The artists wouldn't, the labels wouldn't touch it. But somewhere around 2000, 2001, when the music business started to nosedive, the label said, wait a second, we're investing, you know, as we've talked before, millions of dollars. And okay, I'm going to admit, I'm going to take the label side here on how this came to be. I'm sure I'll get slaughtered for it. But the label's perspective was they're investing millions of dollars in these individual recording artists, and they're not receiving at least a portion of the benefit from that investment. The term branding started becoming really popular. The idea was that nobody cares about Garth Brooks' history but for the fact that he was a superstar recording artist on Capitol Records. Or, you know, nobody wants to buy, you know, a Nickelback t-shirt but for the fact that they are a very successful recording artist with songs that are hits on the radio and all this stuff. So the idea is that the label said, we're making all this investment, we're losing money hand over fist to peer-to-peer file sharing, and we're not seeing the return on the investment that we used to. So the logic is, but at the same time, the artists were, at least, again, the theory goes, they were making more and more money proportionately on concerts, t-shirts, merchandise, commercials, endorsement deals, all that stuff, sometimes licensing of the masters for other purposes. So the label said, for us to continue making this investment, we need to get another some more income streams happening here. That's where the 360 deals evolved from. So the idea is that now, if you sign as an artist with a major label, and a lot of times, a lot of indie labels are getting deep into this as well, the label will now start receiving a percentage of your touring income and your merchandise and your music publishing, that sort of thing. So that's kind of the heart and soul, I think, of what a 360 deal is. How I was there the first time in a meeting at a major when they said, we're going to include this new paragraph in our recording artist agreement. I thought, oh, dear mother of God, you've got to be kidding me. I have a hard enough time getting artists to sign these things as we have them now. So it was met with fierce resistance. And it was viewed as a power grab by the labels. When, you know, power grab, fair, not fair, happy, not happy, I don't know. But at the end of the day, the labels were dying. You know, you can blame, there's all sorts of blame and all that stuff, but they were losing a lot more money. And the net effect is they have less money to invest. And so, you know, that was the argument. And again, fierce resistance because the initial deals were in just really high percentage of the artist's income. And the artists would demand a really huge advance in exchange for it. And it was just nuts. Finally, it kind of eventually settled down to the point where the deals that I see these days are, they're small percentages. There might be some slight increase in the advance in exchange for this new stream of income.
Or the royalty rate.
Yeah, or the royalty rate increases, that's right. Because the big danger, especially in the early days, was it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that when the artist started signing away all these additional income streams, like, you know, for example, one major came out and they wanted 25% of all this money, which that may not sound too significant, but if you're representing the artist, the manager gets, you know, 15 or 20% on top of that. Business manager might get, say, 5%. And then, what are we up to?
The agent.
Yeah, the agent. Yeah. It. You
Lawyer?
Yeah. Sure, yeah.
Forget us.
Not me.
Everybody takes a piece of that cheese, and by the time it gets to the artist, there's nothing left.
Yeah. I had an artist client who was given a deal a couple of years ago, and based on that artist's situation, we just had to tell them no thanks, because if they signed the deal due to the 360 and all the other hands that were in the artist's pockets, there was nothing left.
Yeah, and to a certain degree, you know, an artist's argument that, look, you want me to agree to give you a piece of the touring, a piece of my merchandise, as you at the label and your overall companies, you're downsizing and you're cutting
right.
people out of marketing departments,
right.
out of radio promotion departments. So what am I getting in terms of touring assistance and help? Where are your experts in touring or in merchandise at the label that I'm giving you basically part of my revenue in order to get something from you? Well, do you have the staff that can even help me or handle this? And
right. Back to like first-year contracts, you know, a bargained for exchange. Okay, I'm all of a sudden now as an artist expecting to give more to the label, the same label whose A&R department is a shell of what it used to be. A&R's artists and repertoire, the people who develop an act. They don't want acts in development at the labels any longer. They want developed acts. They want you to come prepackaged. They want you to come with what they call traction, where you can show that you are able to sell CDs today. And that means coming with your MySpace, your Facebook, your all your stuff set up. You may have street teams. You may have a following. They can come to a showcase and see that you pack the showcase. They want prepackaged acts. So what they used to do is they used to give you a lot of advisors and people who would work with you, executives at these labels who would work with you to develop this brand. They don't do that anymore as much. Yet now they're saying because of the brand, we want a chunk of it. And to say that Garth Brooks would not, nobody'd care about Garth Brooks' background if it wasn't for Garth Brooks, the recording artist on the label, Garth Brooks' response to you would be, nobody'd care about the label if it wasn't for the Garth Brookses of the world.
That is his
response. I know, I've heard him say it. That's his right. response.
Right.
So it's like, what is Columbia without artists?
Right.
It is just an incorporated entity that has no product. So
another thing is, let me tell you something. Living on a tour bus sucks. It's miserable. I won't go out with my husband. I don't care what happens out there as long as I don't have to ride on that tour bus. I'm serious. So, you know, that's another couple of things to think about, and this is like whether this is fair or not, is that the way the label recoupment system is set up is, you know, even though the label is fronting the money, a disproportionate share of it is being recouped out of the artist's share of income. And it seems like one of the problems that the labels have, it's going to take them a while to get over this, was just this very inefficient use of resources and this reverse economy of scale. And so from an artist's point of view, we're like, make your business model work better. Don't just, you know, grab us as your life preserver. You know, you're a sinking ship.
Interesting points all of you made in respect of what an artist's brand is, and especially how the labels now expect that brand to be existing prior to even basically having any interest, for the most part, in an artist. That's why we see a lot of signings from American Idol and other shows, because at least there's built-in brand there, built-in audience, and I've heard it said at some labels that they want to know all the data from MySpace, Facebook, and all the other presences on the web that the artist has. How many hits are they getting? To see how strong that brand is before they'll even think about signing the artist. So just maybe talk about that branding issue a little bit more, and what artists are doing in particular in the digital world with respect to branding. And is it just a given now that if you're a recording artist, whether on a major or on an indie, that you have to have a Facebook page, you have to be on MySpace, you have to, everywhere you can go, and, you know, Twitter, wherever you can be?
Yeah, I would say that much of my practice is about counseling clients about how to emerge. So with respect to the fact that a label, if you were seeking a label deal, the fact that a label expects you to be sort of self-contained and mature, sophisticated, developed prior to them having an interest in you, I counsel clients to, if you want a deal ultimately, that's certainly a goal that you can pursue. But given that the route these days is to be self-developed, act as your own label. And I'm on a mission to preach that gospel everywhere I go. Act as your own label, create your own success, and internet marketing is certainly an aspect of that, and gives you the sort of opportunity to do that that didn't exist in the way that it once did. So with respect to branding, how you can create that brand as an artist is, now you have entree to lots of homes and organizations and audiences that you wouldn't have previously, because the internet gives you that kind of entree to the extent that you're strategic about it, which is something that I think that artists don't necessarily understand is, so what does that mean? What is internet branding? What is internet marketing? How am I strategic? Is it sufficient just to have a MySpace page or a Facebook page, or how will you garner attention? Everybody's got a has a MySpace page now. So that doesn't really create success. So I spend time with clients talking about how to create, how to stand out on the internet. And the digital marketplace is different, so that you can do that, which requires knowing who you are as an artist. So the branding has to be internal. Having defined yourself as an artist, now this is something that you can create as a brand and then market once you have a sense of who you are, and developing that in every way, creating a real interest in what you do, and not just in the music that you create, but in you as an artist. So that's been kind of fun to talk about and to help clients to understand that there are these new opportunities. Having said that, I do think that that changes options for artists, so that ultimately maybe you're not still seeking a label deal. Because if you can create that kind of success and make a living doing it, which is not necessarily being Britney Spears, but you can make a living doing that, then maybe you don't need a label deal.
Other thoughts on artist branding, Ken?
I was going to say the use of technology. I see this a lot with my students at Middle Tennessee State. I have a lot of students in my class in the recording industry program that are aspiring artists, and I like to ask them a lot, where are you performing? And a lot of them are like, well, I'm on the internet. And as Cheryl said, so is everybody else. And the reason we have so many in the history of music one-hit wonders, or their very first CD sold well, but then their sophomore effort doesn't, or those types of things, is because when artists go out and tour and play gigs and they're in front of crowds, they play a lot of music. And they can gauge, they get feedback from the crowd, from a live crowd. And they say, you know what, every time we play that song, people head to the bar and get a beer. They don't really, but when we play this song, they come towards the stage. You get this feedback from live performances that you don't get from the internet. So the internet I see it's a very good tool in your toolbox, but it can't be the only one in there, because then it just rattles around and makes noise.
And how do you stand out in a crowd? How do people even find you?
Right. And you have to hone those songs.
There's a couple things we haven't talked about is the power of the blog, and also these placement companies. Mm-hmm. And they are looking, they're some of the only people in the business who are looking for new artists. I mean, not even indie labels are not looking for artists. They don't want artists. But these placement companies for film and television, and a couple of examples are Zinc, or Natural Energy Lab, or Music for the Masses, or Secret Road, which is run by the woman who manages Ingrid Michaelson. They are specializing in placing artists on television shows. And that's good for the television networks because they're paying less money. Because you can get a new indie artist, or some of them aren't even signed yet, for $7,000. Or you can go pay upwards of 20 for one on a major. And I think that in the past few years, one of the most cutting-edge uses of music and visuals has been television commercials. And talk about, you know, branding and dangers to branding. That can be really treacherous. But it's crucial. And I have, you know, clients lying on the beach in Mexico saying, no, we're not doing this Miller beer commercial. It looks stupid. I'm like, well, okay. Well, you know, you're probably right. You probably shouldn't have done that stupid Lee Jeans commercial last year. And I certainly don't want to hear any more complaints about the fact that you haven't had another major campaign since that one, because you only did that one because you were nerds in high school and you wore Lee Jeans and you think there's some sort of reverse cool in there. Well, guess what? Not everyone agrees. but those are a couple of other ways you can find to stand out that are... And some of the bloggers out there, they actually still like music. And frankly, I don't. I got into this because I did, but now it's like, turn that stuff off, honey. I don't want to hear it. It's like, can we play something that was recorded before I was born? that I cannot possibly have had any business relationship with.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's like hearing your worst nightmare, you know. You hear that song and go, oh, no, that producer deal still isn't finished yet.
That's right.
It's like a reminder.
I should be at the office, yeah. Right? Yeah.
I'm all talk radio these days.
Brief on that one. Or,
yeah. That's right.
That's the problem with getting into doing something you love as work. You create work out of the things
you
love. Go
into Blockbuster and you know, you're halfway down the new release aisle and you're like, I've seen six things I worked on. Get me out of here.
Yeah,
very true. Cautionary tales. When I still lived in LA and was in business and legal affairs at A&M Records, I decided I needed to take a yoga class at my club, so I signed up for it and I took it. And in the first class, the yoga instructor said that she was a big Sting fan, so the entire class was going to use Sting music. And of course, I immediately thought, get me out of here. I've got 10 deals on my desk for Sting that aren't done, and they're keeping me up at night. And now this is my reward to go to yoga class for relaxation, and it's all Sting all the time. The digital world, and we don't have much time left, but this is really important, obviously. There's been a huge shift in our industry, and as everyone out here knows, music industry hasn't been doing well for a long time now. CD sales are down to record low, no pun intended, record low levels.
Good one.
And everyone's saying, you know, the digital world is going to save us, presumably. Artists have to be on MySpace, Facebook, everywhere else. iTunes, sell as many as you can. The downloads. In reality, what does an artist get from a single download from iTunes, just in general? Are we talking about dollars? Are we talking about pennies?
I'm talking about pennies.
Oh, yeah.
Are we trading dollars for on hard physical product for digital pennies, basically?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're probably talking like, what, 7 to 10.5, 11 cents?
Yeah.
Per download?
It depends on whether, and this is something that, this is a deal point in record label, in record deals, but is this going to be treated as license income, where the artist is going to get 50% of it, and that's going to happen a lot more often on an indie label, or is it going to be, are you going to get the same royalty rate as you do for regular sales, even though theoretically the costs are a lot less?
Right, in which event you could be making as an artist about 8 cents per digital download on iTunes.
Or you could be making 35, 40.
If it's treated as a license, right. Okay, so is the digital world, is all this, is it saving us, or do we just not know yet? We're not in a place where we can even gauge that yet.
One of my artists just had a record come out. It was really hot. Half his sales were digital.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, his business is getting bigger every year. And I've got a handful of those. I've got two or three clients like that. For a lot of people, it's not working. And so I think the jury is still so out on this.
And the interesting thing about it is, you know, the record labels are spending all of this money on transporting physical product into brick and mortar stores, and it's inefficient when compared to the download, but they'd also sell an album that may only have two really good songs on it, and you have 10 songs on the album, 8 of which nobody really cares about. They're really buying it for that one or two songs, whereas they spend $15 for that, whereas now on iTunes, they're spending 99 cents for the one song that they liked. And so that's changed the whole dynamic. Yeah, you have a much more efficient system, but it's changed that dynamic a lot. There's some who argue that the consumers are much happier with that because they can just buy that single song, and that may drive more consumers to purchasing music. Mm-hmm. Or like with the downturn we have right now in economics, you're going to see an uptick in movies. It's escapism. People want to go see a movie. But when people are hurting for cash, they're just going to keep listening to their old favorite songs instead of going out and buying a $15 CD. Has it changed a little now that we're back to the single being dominant like it was 40 years ago? Are people willing to spend the 99 cents now instead of the $15? So I don't know.
We're going to get to questions in a minute, but just by way of summary, we spend a lot of time, I know every time I go to lunch with a lawyer or an executive at a record company or even an artist, we spend a lot of time talking about what's wrong with the music business right now. what's right with the music business? I can think of one thing. People, in various studies that have been conducted, people are listening to more music at this particular time than any other time. So that's great. I mean, there's people love music, except for Elizabeth. Anybody just briefly think off the top of their heads, what's right with the industry right now?
Well, I think it's an exciting time to be in the music industry, particularly from the perspective of independent industry. I actually do think that the perception is amongst independent artists and labels is that we can maybe build a better mousetrap than the majors could. We can create some new business models, and maybe people will actually buy our product because the majors are no longer quite so powerful. And to the extent that there's quality music being created, and there's lots of it, then there are lots of new opportunities and lots of little cottage industries that are springing up. I have clients that are neither artists nor labels, but have some kind of internet presence that supports the music industry in some different, new and different ways. So I think that there are lots of new opportunities.
Jones? Yeah, I think one of two things are going to happen in the next 10 years. Either the music business is going to completely turn around and just shoot off, or it's going to die. Hopefully not. And I don't think so, because I feel that, at least with the people I work with, in the music industry, they still tend to be some of the brightest, shrewdest, smartest, most creative people I've ever met in my life. And I mentioned before that I'm a patent lawyer. The major reason why I became a patent lawyer after being an entertainment lawyer is that one can patent, that's a little debatable now, but in theory, one can patent a business method or a business model. A lot of people don't realize that. And the music business is now getting, the patent world is getting flooded with these new ideas, new business models. I mean, especially with sort of the implementation of widgets on MySpace and Facebook, there are countless patent applications hitting the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office right now. Sooner or later, the next really big idea, I believe very strongly, is going to come, and I feel like it's just right around the corner. I don't think iTunes was the next really big idea. I think that's just almost like a placeholder, but you know, everything I hear from my clients is that the consumption of music, like we talked about, commercials, TV, films, it is everywhere. You know, you can have it on your phone, you can have it here, you can have it there. I can't remember a time when music has been so dominant, so ever present. So the question is, how do you monetize that so that the people who are making it can actually be reimbursed? And I don't know. I have a lot of faith. I have a whole lot of faith that we'll see it quickly.
It's a good note because of the amount of innovation. I mean, people it's a frenzy.
And people are so passionate about it as well. You know, it's not like, yay, I found this new, injection device to give you a new vaccine. And people get fired up about, you know, their favorite type of music.
Good notes to end on. Questions for our panel members? Anybody?
I'm one of those digital converts. I buy everything on iTunes. I don't think I've bought a CD in years, sorry. But I recently wrote a submission to the journal that we were screening, and the author was talking about how when CDs came out as a new format, they were almost immediately adopted by the music-consuming public as a replacement for records. But when digital music came out, at least as of the end of 2007, which was the latest statistic, digital consumption remained a very small, I was astounded how small the proportion of the music industry, and the author was positing that it was because of diffusion problems and copyright law, but I was curious to see if you guys had any thoughts on why this digital forum that seems so convenient, so great, really hasn't taken off the way CDs did.
I'm actually going to speak as a consumer. And not just as an attorney, because I remember the switch from CDs, from albums to CDs. I remember that. And I remember, and by the way, I have an iPod that I've had for almost 3 years and doesn't have one piece of music on it. So a little insight into me. But I remember being very resistant to CDs. had lots of albums, loved my album collection, like a lot of older music too, and the thought of having to replace all of that with CDs did not appeal to me. I remember distinctly, though, that at some point, albums just weren't available. You couldn't buy them. It wasn't an option. I went kicking and screaming into CDs because I could no longer buy albums. With CDs to digital, you can still walk into Barnes & Noble and everywhere else, and you can still purchase CDs. I actually think that that's one of the reasons that the transition hasn't been so immediate. There are still, it's a generational issue, I think. I'm clearly a little bit resistant to this technological change, and I own that. So with respect to, you know, the consuming public who is comfortable now with this CD collection that they've created and comfortable with the technology that they use to play it, to have the learning curve thing, it's one of my issues. I really don't want to have to learn how to do it, even if it's easy, I don't want to. So I think that for the holdouts that are still out there, just don't make them available to us anymore. I mean, I think that that's what it's going to take, in part, to make that change.
Happen in the next few years, especially as maybe the music industry continues to struggle?
I think that it's a possibility because we're already seeing shelf space at the big box stores, Walmart, Best Buy, for the amount of space allocated for CD product has decreased tremendously, even very recently. And is it Borders that just said they were liquidating a lot of their CDs to get rid of the footage in the store they want to use for other purposes?
Yeah, Walmart's talking about it too. I mean, Walmart a couple of years ago accounted for 90% of country music sales. So, yeah.
Which hurt the music industry going to the big box.
There's
all kinds of problems with that. If you sell your product at Tower Records, it's much different than selling it at Walmart, where they allocate this small portion. You can only get so many records into it. And I think part of the reason you don't see this transition as being as quick now is because the labels who are controlling the product, the content, pushed back against digital because they saw digital as uncontrollable. You have, you can control a scarcity of resources on physical product. You can't on digital stuff that's just ones and zeros. So you had a pushback and you had the labels continuing to put the product in the stores. That's where that comes from, I think.
I was going to say, I mean, from my own perspective, I mean, I'm a recent convert to iTunes. I went kicking and screaming into the CD world, kicking and screaming into the iTunes world. But now I'm here in the iTunes world, right? So I got an iPod, and I spent a lot of hard-earned money to put a lot of my favorite old songs on my iPod. Battery's dead, and you can't transfer it out. You know, that's so. It's
charge it.
I can play my CD. Well,
you just plug it in.
And it charges. No, man.
He couldn't find the compartment to put new batteries in.
The battery's dead and it's not rechargeable. Batteries die.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
They can no longer take a charge anymore. But okay, so that is gone, right? All the whatever hundreds of dollars I spent it's gone. And I come from a generation where, by God, if you spent your money on music, you had something. You looked at it. You could hold it. You could put it in the closet. I pull out my old Bruce Springsteen LPs from time to time to introduce my kids to the concept of this black thing that used to spin. That's kind of one issue, I think, is that you can't really save it. I think people are really starting to realize that you can't forever own this thing that you're paying your money for.
And what's next that's going to replace this?
Yeah,
tapes. I had a bunch of money invested in tapes, and they just wore out,
they
too.
Were bad,
you know,
technology.
Bad technology with tapes.
They were bad.
But I have a bunch of vinyl that's scratched now because I moved a lot. And so there's always that issue.
Yeah. Sure.
That's true,
but...
any other questions? I want to make sure that if you guys have questions, we get to them. So... Yes.
How has the change in the radio industry affected music?
We don't have time.
How much time have you got? death, I think. It's killed it. Or at least a lot of it, I feel. I think, I'll try to make this one sentence. In the rock world, at least, I feel that there are now so many outlets where people get their music, you know, MySpace, internet, whatever, that there are no major outlets, and I think that's one reason why we don't see many big selling acts anymore. There are too many choices. I think the death of radio in that world is certainly contributing to it.
The death of radio is pretty much irrelevant in my world. College radio is still important, what's happening on the internet is, and frankly on the MySpace page is way more important. But when you have an artist that is got a song that's working at radio, you used to see checks come in from ASCAP or BMI that were $60,000, $100,000 at a time. It was big money. And maybe it was just another one of those worlds where it was just so, the transfer of money around, it was so inefficient that it could not. And poor old Elliot Spitzer, I mean, he, God bless him before he, that's not going to go right. God bless him before he fell out of favor. He did really attack the payola practices because that was one of the first places that the major labels showed that they were in trouble, was they couldn't pay $300,000, $500,000 to push a single anymore. And they didn't feel like they were getting their money's worth.
The interesting thing you said about TV earlier is 15 years ago, if you tried to get an act of the caliber of Coldplay to do a commercial, you'd be like, no, we're not doing that. Now the best thing to do is not get on the radio, but to get on an iTunes commercial. You want to take off in the charts and get a number one with a bullet. You want to be on an iTunes commercial, not on Lightning 100 or even corporate radio.
We hire people to actively seek that.
Yeah.
I can only think of one instance where an artist has been punished for being in an ad, and that was Wilco.
Oh.
okay, besides Lee my jeans. Own. It was like a bunch of dads in a garage wearing jeans, and the waistlines were all too high. It's just like, it was bad. is Wilco. Wilco did a Volkswagen commercial a couple of years ago. Now, listen. I know it's better to ride your bicycle, but if you're going to drive a car, a little Volkswagen is going to be fairly low impact on the environment. What is wrong with doing a Volkswagen commercial? You know, I did have a client turn down a Hummer commercial. Like, we cannot go there. You know, we're not like the most, socially responsive people in the world, but we cannot do a Hummer commercial. But there's always a fear that there's going to be that backlash, and sometimes it happens, and I don't know why it happens sometimes and doesn't 90% of the other times. One of my clients is a band called the Black Keys. You have heard them everywhere. You have heard them in Victoria's Secret commercials. American Express commercials. There's Shaun White tracing the freshest, he's chasing the freshest snow around the world, and it's for American Express. I mean, there's nothing cool about American Express, but there was something really cool about Shaun White chasing snow around the world. And I've decided that it really doesn't have anything to do with the product that's being sold. It has to do, or who is selling it. It has to do with how cool the ad looks.
Good point. Does anyone have a final question? Okay.
Well, thank you to the panelists.
I want to thank you all for joining us today. If you're here for CLE credit, if you could turn those in at the registration desk, that would be wonderful. We do have a brief reception outside if you all want to stop for some snacks and beverages. Thank you to my team and the rest of the Jet Law membership for joining us and the rest of our guests today. We have a wonderful rest of your Friday.
Thank you.